Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Mark Gaberti, and this is a podcast for entrepreneurs who are looking for the breakthrough for their businesses. Entrepreneurship is often depicted as a game of patience, strategizing, and persistence. While the strategizing and persisting parts are definitely true, one entrepreneur wrote the guide for impatient entrepreneurs who aspire to turn their experience into profit. Today's guest is an entrepreneur, speaker, and author. As a weekly Forbes contributor who writes about branding for small businesses, she has spoken at a host of entrepreneurial organizations, including the Million Dollar Women Summit and Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Businesses. Today's guest for episode 104 of the Breakthrough Success Podcast is none other than Pia Silva. Pia, it is such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Mark. Great to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show, and I really look forward to diving in, but I'd like to get some backstory first. So why did you first write your book to basically act as a guide for impatient entrepreneurs who want to turn their experience into profit?
Great question. Why did I write the book? Well, in my experience, personally, and then what I've observed in the entrepreneurial world is that there are a ton of people out there with a lot of expertise, very good at what they do, and they have a very hard time actually finding the right clients, getting paid what they're worth. They spend a lot of time just spinning their wheels, networking, and not enough time actually delivering on the value that they have. So my book, you know, Badass Your Brand, is all about finding out what that what that special thing is about you and how to communicate it so that you can actually attract the exact kind of clients you want. And you can stop wasting all of your time just constantly hunting for clients and instead spend that time creating value in the world, you know, working with the people that you should be working with, that you can help, and so that you both can be prosperous.
And I love that idea behind the book, and I did read it to prepare for this interview.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. And when I first come across the idea of impatient entrepreneurs who can become successful, like, I think at first I thought, like, well, entrepreneurship is so often depicted as a game of patience, but you mentioned that you and your partner, Steve, I mean, you hit $100,000 per year in your first full year of business. So that's what made me realize that this is for, like, you don't have to wait like so many years in order to make that much revenue. But how were you able to achieve that level of income so quickly?
Well, right. So we did have some early success. We did hit $100,000 in our first year. But mind you, that's two people living in New York City, working 24/7, really. And we're working for pennies. So you can hit $100,000 a year if you're willing to work all the time. And that's kind of what we did. So our first success, it felt good because we weren't sure we could even hit that number. But very quickly, it became, okay, but I can't actually sustain this way of working. I can't sustain this lifestyle. And so, you know, that's when we started to grow our business. You know, I looked around at what other people were doing. We started to grow an agency. We hired a couple of employees. We were going after bigger projects. We were trying to get higher priced projects so that we could make more money in less time. And as I detail in the book, essentially, that was a nice idea, but it landed us in debt. So even though that was, you know, there was a lot of good intention there, it actually failed us. And only when we kind of reevaluated what it really meant to be profitable and to what success and freedom really looked like to us, could we then actually build a model that was profitable and that did give us the success that we personally were looking for. And that just has a lot to do with being very strategic. So when I say impatient, I'm talking about being really specific and strategic about who you go after and not wasting time just spraying bullets all over the place and seeing what hits.
And impatience does get the implication that you get the result faster, but there's obviously a lot more work that goes into getting that result, as you mentioned. And it's interesting how you mentioned that it was helpful when you started to hire employees. Even then, you needed the model in place for you to achieve the success that you achieved. But I feel like people in a similar position where they're making that $100,000 a year or something that's respectable, and they feel like they're working 24/7, but I don't feel like these same people are ready right away to give their work to other people. So what type of a shift did you have to go to start giving your work to some of your employees?
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. And it was a very big challenge for me. I think most entrepreneurs who work on their own, or, you know, I was working with my partner, we're control freaks. You know, we want everything to be the way that we want. And certainly it was one of the biggest challenges to bring in two employees and start to offload our work to them. And to be perfectly honest, I had never done it before. So it was challenging. I wasn't great at it. And ultimately they were very expensive, and they doubled our overhead having the two employees. So that's part of why we ended up going into debt, was because our overhead was so high. And because our overhead was high, we had to get bigger projects in order to pay for it. So, you know, I'm probably not the best person to talk about how to offload that work. Here we are years later. I don't have internal employees, and I'm going to keep it that way. But I do have lots of people who work for me. I just prefer to work with contractors because they all bring expertise, and I prefer to hire people who are going to bring higher level thought and strategy and actually help me figure out what to do. And they aren't just doing whatever I ask them to do. So that's the way that I have solved that problem. And I, you know, I teach entrepreneurs how to do that because I find that that is a higher level of value than hiring employees at the least you can pay for them, and then having to train them on everything. It's actually a big use of, you know, you have to use your time to do that. And you have to weigh the costs and benefits of spending that time training someone versus hiring someone who's actually going to bring expertise that you don't even have to the table. So that's the model I prefer.
And one of the other things that I came across when I was reading your book is that there are a lot of people who they're afraid to like charge over $100, and you are able to charge premium prices for the services that you provide. And I'm wondering, how do we get to that point where we're more able to offer premium prices, whether it's for a product or a service?
Sure. I mean, that's kind of the crux of what I help my clients do and what I teach in the book. It's how to position your business so that you are actually offering something that's worth a premium price. And a lot of it has to do with owning a very specific expertise, owning a niche, owning a process, building a way of doing things that nobody else does. I call it, you know, put yourself in a category of one. Nobody else is an expert in this space, doing this process, using this methodology, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The more you can be specific in all of these aspects, the more you are taking yourself apart from the competition. And when you do that, when you're the only person that really plays in this particular space, you can charge whatever you want, because somebody who wants to hire you isn't going to be able to get it anywhere else. So it's a combination of putting that stuff together so that you, in a forward-facing, you know, brand communications, you're communicating to someone that they can't get this anywhere else. And then simultaneously, you end up building your confidence because you know they can't get it anywhere else either. So you know that it's worth it.
And I really love how you broke down those premium prices, that I feel not enough of us are willing to charge so high for our services. You see the person charging like $50 for a consultation session or something like that, where other people are easily charging thousands of dollars. So I always do find that interesting how some people are charging premium prices and then able to get fewer clients, but they're able to, like, they're making the same amount of income but fewer clients. So I've always found that really interesting. And one of the things that I read about in your book, you talked about networking and how when you were at these events, you had a selling mindset in the beginning, and what really allowed you to strike it in was embracing an anti-selling mindset. So I was wondering if you could share with us the difference between those two mindsets and how you made the shift.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in retrospect, this is the key to, I think, a lot of the successful conversations that I've had with people over the years and how I'm able to close. I hate sales. When I think of sales, I get that icky feeling. I think a lot of people get it. But I realized I'm a great salesperson. I'm a great salesperson because I'm not selling ever. So I call a selling mindset is really in your mind, you're trying to get the sale. You're speaking to someone and you're trying to figure out how you can convince them that you're the best or convince them that they really should buy from you. And that doesn't feel good. That doesn't feel good to be on the other end of that either, right? I think we can all agree that when you feel like someone's trying to sell you, you kind of immediately start to, step away. So the anti-selling mindset is the opposite. In fact, I spend most of my energy trying to figure out and suss out if they really are a good fit. And I'm trying to find any way that they aren't, because I'm trying to avoid working with anyone who isn't going to be a perfect client. And what that means is I'm trying to be helpful to them. So I want to listen. I want to ask a lot of questions, figure out what their situation is. Why are we talking right now? You know, what's your challenge? What are you trying to solve? Do they even know that they have a problem, and are they willing to solve it? I mean, that's a key for me, is I need to be working with someone who actually wants to make a profit. I tell people, if you're doing this as a hobby, you're not a good fit for me, because when I come back to you with strategies that are going to make you money and you aren't really looking for money, that's not your priority, then you might not want to implement those strategies. So there's a lot of criteria that I have for a very good client. And therefore, the anti-selling mindset and conversation is all about just trying to understand them and trying to be helpful. So often the most helpful thing to do is to say, I'm not a good fit for you, or you really should actually look over here or look for someone who does this, because branding is not going to solve that problem. But I find that conversation, that mind frame, mindset takes the pressure off of the conversation completely, because they don't feel like they're being sold to, and I don't feel like I'm trying to sell them. And when you do that, when you're speaking to a perfect client who actually is a great fit for you, who actually could really benefit from your services, that person usually sells themselves, because after a conversation with somebody like that, they'll just say, okay, great. Well, how do I hire you? So they'll actually initiate the sale instead of you having to do it.
It's always great to get the other person to have a strong interest without you having to keep pushing. But I mean, this is really spot on for the long term. I see some people thinking, though, that, I mean, some people are like trying to get any client that they can possibly get for the short term, while that may be bad for the long term. People sometimes think in that short term sense. So how did you get to the point where you're saying no to people who wouldn't be a good fit? Because I feel like some people will take on any client who comes in.
Yeah. And I know it's scary when you need clients to turn down potential work. So I'm not trying to take anything away from the fear of needing a client right now and not being able to say no. The way that I did it was really to start saying no to everyone outside of our niche. So we repackaged our services after we went into debt into the model that we do now, which we do this two-step model called a brand shrink and a brand up. And the brand up is a 1 to 3 day intensive where we build your entire brand. There's, you know, more details to that we can talk about if you want. But in general, building an entire brand strategy, design of the logo, the design and build of the website, the copy, all the materials, doing all of that in a 1 to 3 day intensive is a pretty unique process. Not many people offer that. I don't know anyone who offers that, actually. But it's also not a good fit for everybody. It wouldn't work for a larger company because they have too many opinions. You know, there's too many people who you need to ask and get sign off from. It doesn't work as well. We found over the years that it doesn't work as well for products for some reason. So, you know, just by owning the process, we ended up saying no to a lot of companies. And that was because we didn't want to fail them. I didn't want to take on a client who where the project wasn't going to work. It wouldn't be in my best interest to do that either. The client would be unhappy. We wouldn't maybe be able to finish the project in time because there's all these opinions in the room. So right off the bat, owning a process will kind of force you to say no to people outside of that process. And then over the years, we have become better and better at understanding who, you know, even more granularly, who's going to be best for this. Now we only work with 1 to 3 person service businesses. Those are the people that we found get the best value out of our process. So I am looking for only those people, and everybody else, I just tell them this isn't a great fit. And I have people who come to me and say, well, I know I sell products and you don't brand products, but do you think you can make an exception? And, you know, it's like, well, we could technically, but it'll just be more work for us. We know that there's another client around the corner. So you'll get there. But in the very beginning, if you just own your process, that's the easiest way to say no to everybody else.
And some people listening to this right now, they may have clients and they were in that mindset of hire the first any client who comes walking in. Other people may be a little deeper into the process where they're able to say yes to some, say no to others. But regardless of how many clients our businesses have, we need to strike that balance between clients, growing our brands, and everything else that happens in life. So how would you recommend balancing all those different assets within our lives?
Well, so I think of each individual client as having multiple levels of value. There's the money they pay you, right? That's the most obvious. They pay you money for your work and that's valuable. We all need money to live. But then there's these other levels of value that I think most people ignore. One of them is the experience of working with that client. Every new client you work with has the potential to give you more experience in your area of expertise. And if you're willing to learn, you can always learn something new. I mean, I learn something new from every client we do. And you know, it gets more and more nuanced as we go forward, but I look for those lessons because I want to get better. And the other thing that is incredibly valuable, or can be if you stay in your niche, is that you build your reputation. So every time you work with a client that is in your specific area of expertise, you are only solidifying that you're the expert in this space. Every time you work with someone outside of your expertise, it's just, I call it fast cash. You know, you traded money for your service, but ultimately it's not giving you long-term brand value. That person is not necessarily probably going to be a very good referral source for the ideal clients. They only know you outside of your niche. You didn't say no to them. So you didn't teach them that you have an area of expertise. You just worked with someone and you traded, again, you just traded time for money. So all of these additional values are what I'm looking for in every client. Are they going to give me the multiple levels of value? Because that's the long-term vision of the business. I'm looking to build this over years, you know, because the more you invest in that kind of value in every client, the easier the clients will come to you over time, because you're planting these seeds with all of these ideal clients who are happy with your work. You're increasing your value and your skills. So you're getting better at your expertise. You can charge more when you're better at your expertise. You can charge more when you're increasing the value of what you do. So, you know, I like to look at the big picture, and every client has the potential to either add or even possibly subtract from that big picture goal.
And when it comes to continuing to do work for those clients and being able to like have that work-life balance in a sense, what is your recommendation for that area?
Well, I think it's a great question, because it's very it's valuable to always figure out what work-life balance sounds like to you, right? It's different for everybody. Over the years, I've continued to refine it. So these days, this summer, we redefined it yet again. So now we only work 1 to 6 p.m., 5 days a week. That's a shift. We used to work from like 10 to 6, 5 days a week. But we realized that work-life balance, you know, we can make it that much more luxurious for ourselves if we're more strategic about how we spend our time. So, you know, you take the amount of money you want to make, the amount of hours that you want to work, and you figure out what price points you need to hit in order to make that happen. Once we hit price points where we could make the 5-hour day work, we you know, we started cutting down on our work, on our workload. And that means outsourcing more and more work as well and being more organized, but it's doable. So I'm here to say that it's definitely doable. And as long as you're very clear on the steps needed to get there, you can get any kind of work-life balance you want.
And work-life balance is such an important area, which is why I bring it up. And a lot, everyone, I feel like, would have a different answer to it, like how to achieve it. Is it even a thing? So that's something I really love to explore. And trust me, I've heard a lot of different opinions about work-life balance. But another thing that I've heard a lot of opinions about is unlocking your potential. And I'm wondering, Pia, if you could share with us, what do you believe holds most people back from reaching their full potential?
Well, I think fear is the obvious one. Is that too cliche? Yeah. I think fear is what's holding everybody back. I think most people make most decisions based on fear and avoiding things that they're scared of. So, you know, one of the biggest things I've done in the last year and a half is, me and my partner did it for our business, but it doesn't seem business related at all. We did a lot of kind of internal work about working our fears and figuring out what our fears are and facing them and doing things to push on them and get more comfortable with them. And it has made all the difference. You know, in the last year and a half, I wrote and published a book and started putting my personal brand out there. That is something that I would never have done before had I not worked through the fears of, I mean, it's scary to put your face out. And my face is on my book, Mark. That's a really scary thing to do, especially someone who like grew up hating photos or having my photo anywhere. So all of a sudden, my face is everywhere. But I was able to do that because I got over the fear of what's really stopping me. Why am I so scared of putting myself out there? I'm scared of, I'm scared of haters. I'm scared of people thinking I suck. But once I kind of worked through that fear and realized what it was really about and kind of got over it, all of a sudden it opened up all these possibilities. And I'm so thankful for that because I know that I've touched a lot of people with my book that I would never have been able to touch had I let my fear dictate what I was going to do.
And I really love that story of how your book, I mean, it is something quite different from normal experiences when you hit that publish button for the first time. Like, it's like, whoa, I'm publishing a blog post for the first time. But then you get to book, yeah. And especially with your own picture, like, I don't like staring at pictures of myself either or anything like that. But that is definitely a very different experience. And I mean, I'm like, we all have different experiences with what it's like, but one of the things that I love about books is that there are just so many of them for us to read, so many specialized books on helping us achieve our goals. And I'm wondering, with that in mind, if you could share with us three great books that would help us grow our businesses.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so my go-to that I always recommend, if you haven't read it, it's a classic, but The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, everybody should read that. That changed my life when I read it. I was at 20 years old and I read it, and I think it changed the trajectory of my life. So I read that every couple of years. Another big one that really made an impact on me is Profit First. Have you heard of Profit First?
I have, Mark? Mike Michalowicz. Yeah?
Mike Michalowicz, he's awesome. Implementing Profit First was very big for me, and I recommend that to everybody as well. And the third one, somewhat recently, I read The Great Leap. Guy Hendrickson, I want to say, profound book that talks about, I don't think he uses the word fear, but I think that, I'm not sure if he used the word fear, but he talks about the idea of fear and basically hitting your upper limits and how to acknowledge them and then how to break past them. So if you're talking about reaching your full potential, The Great Leap is an amazing book for that.
Pia, thank you for those great book recommendations. That last book, I've heard it multiple times. I have not read it yet. So that's going to be something that I finally get around the corner to do. So thank you for sharing with us all those great book recommendations.
Great. It's worth it. 2018 started off
definitely
started off with a boom.
That's definitely a book that I do plan on adding to my reading list, and I'll read it by first quarter 2018 and let people know my thoughts on it. But I would like to flip the tables a little bit. So I've asked you a bunch of questions throughout our time together, and I'm wondering, what is one question that you believe we need to be asking ourselves more often?
The question that's on my mind today as I go into a new year is not what do I want to accomplish, but how do I want to feel? So I'm preaching a lot this January about connecting your goals to what the ultimate goal is. Usually we try to accomplish things, but we're really just trying to accomplish them so we can feel a certain way. So instead of just coming up with a list of targets, ask yourself, like, what do you really want that's different in your life? Do you want peace? Do you want to feel successful? You know, what does that look like? And make sure your goals are tied to that feeling. Because ultimately, you can achieve all the goals in the world, but if you don't achieve the feeling that you're going for, you'll just keep spinning your wheels and going farther.
That is a different question that I normally get. Like, think about how we want to feel. Like, yes, it's important to pursue our goals, but we could accomplish all of our goals but then feel terrible. So I really love that question about thinking about how you feel, not just from like being successful, but also how you feel about yourself and about your work throughout the year.
Great. Yeah. I mean, when I started shifting into that kind of framework, I actually hit my goals much more quickly.
That is something that I'm definitely going to try myself, focusing more about how I feel than how close or far I am away from one particular goal. And I really appreciate you taking the time to share all of your great insights throughout this episode. And for Breakthrough Success listeners wondering, rumor around the block is that we are getting a free chapter from your book. So where can we get that?
Yeah. I'd love to share with you guys the first chapter of my book and a bonus, although Ooh. It's really even probably bigger than the first chapter of my book. I'll share with you guys my brand shrink interview. So this is the interview I give all my clients to figure out what is so badass and amazing about their business. So it's 80 questions, so don't take it lightly. But if you take the time and answer those questions, you will get insights into your business. So I put that up at badassyourbrand.com/breakthrough-success.
Pia, thank you for providing that great resource and for sharing all of your great insights. It was such a pleasure to have you on the Breakthrough Success podcast.
The pleasure was all mine, Mark. Thank you so much.
How does over 100 retweets per day sound to you? My free ebook, 27 Ways to Get More Retweets on Twitter, has you covered. I use the methods within this ebook to get over 10,000 retweets every single quarter. To learn more and get access to this free resource, visit markgoberti.com/retweets.